This is the tax update for December 29, 2007. This time, considering year-end tax law changes that the Congress has given us. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use to include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Congress has given us this week three different bills, actually in recent days, three different bills that passed here at the end of their session before they left town for the holiday recess. Now, the fix for the AMT problem was the one that got the most press and certainly was one of us following most closely, but all three bills contain some items that are of interest to taxpayers or that are of interest to us as practitioners, and all of them have things that may impact our clients that we need to be aware of. So we want to take a look at all three bills. Now, all three bills, the bills either have been signed by the president or we expect the president to sign them. There doesn't appear to be any problem here with any of these bills becoming law. So we're going to treat them as if they go into law and, deal with that issue. If one of them were to be vetoed in the unlikely event that happened, obviously that puts it on hold. But we will presume that's not going to happen. The other thing to remember is Congress is holding one military-related tax bill because the Senate and House couldn't come to agreement on a conference bill before they left town. So there is one more bill that's floating out there that we may see early in 2008 that may come in and have some impacts. But we're not going to talk about that bill. We're going to talk about some of the key issues that were impacted by three bills that passed. Now, in essence, we had three bills. The bills in question were the Tax Increase Prevention Act of 2007. That's the AMT fix. We also had the Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act of 2007 and the Tax Technical Corrections Act of 2007. Those three bills all were passed here in the final few days of this congressional session. And all three of them have impact on tax matters. Now, let's start with the AMT fix just to get the easy one out of the way. This is a mechanical fix. They played with the numbers somewhat to try to get them inflation adjusted. So some of the numbers you may have seen given for the new exemption are probably going to be different than the number that actually passed in the end because that was adjusted as they went through the process. And the theory being they're trying to find a truly inflation adjusted number. So they worked that, but the numbers they finally agreed upon was that the exemption for 2007 is going to be $66,250 for a married couple. That's up from the $45,000 it would have been had they not passed this change. $44,350 for unmarried taxpayers, up from the $33,750 otherwise would have been in play. And $33,125 for a married couple filing a separate return. That's up from the $22,500 that otherwise would have applied. The bill also provides that the non-refundable personal tax credits can be offset against the AMT. That provision also had expired. Now, a key factor to notice is this only fixes this problem for 2007, meaning at the end of 2008, we may very well be back in the same position one more time with the Congress looking at extending this provision at the last minute. Don't forget as well that because of the late changes that were made in this provision and the fact it affects so many tax forms, the IRS has already indicated they expect to get off to a late start in this filing season. Refunds are expected to be delayed, and a number of other issues will come into play. It may be a very bumpy season at the front end, especially if you're attempting to electronically file returns, because it may be a while before all the forms can be accepted. Other issues may arise. So be very careful at the front end of the tax season. It may take a while for the IRS to get up to speed. So you're just going to need to be ready for that as we get into the filing season going forward. Now, the big fight on that bill was whether or not it should be offset under the PAYGO provisions. And in the end, they passed a bill that was not, the revenue was not offset. What that means is this bill is basically clean. The only thing it does is fix the AMT, period. There was no offsetting revenue increase. The other two bills we're going to talk about both had offsetting revenue increase provisions. Therefore, they were zero they were considered zero cost bills. As such, it means anytime they grant a benefit, I should say the first one, the second one is considered zero cost as a technical correction. But the first one is zero cost because we had offsets in the bill. And we're going to talk about one of the offsets there. The other interesting part is one of the offsets was borrowed yet again to provide tax relief related to the Hokie Memorial Fund and receipt of those benefits by certain individuals. And to pay for that, we went back and revisited one change that was made in the mortgage bill to basically hit a revenue raiser one more time. Now, the mortgage bill was best known for its main provision, which allows for an issue where a taxpayer who's had their house taken, because we've seen a number of issues of areas of the country where real estate values have fallen, where values were bid up. Arizona is a good example where I'm located. In Arizona, we had a number of, shall we call them, creative mortgages done where individuals qualified to move into a home. And they did so with, shall we say, teaser interest rates that were at a very low level. They were paying interest-only mortgages at rates that were fixed at relatively low levels and that would reset. Prices have collapsed in the interim. And what has happened since then is, and many of those mortgages have come up for refinancing. Individuals either cannot qualify for refinancing or the interest rates are going to reset. And when those interest rates reset, they can no longer afford the house. Well, for the various reasons of those particular programs and the fact that people are losing their homes under them, we have a potential problem. Because if you have a mortgage on your home, let's say for $500,000, and the home is taken back at a time when its fair value is $400,000, you have a bifurcated transaction. That is, the $400,000, presuming that we have a mortgage that is recourse to the taxpayer. So they owe the extra $100,000 on the mortgage. We take the $400,000. That is the sale of the property for the fair value, and we sell it for $400,000. There's $100,000 remaining debt that the taxpayer owes on a recourse mortgage. In many cases, the lenders give up trying to collect that because there is no way they're going to collect it. But the problem is under Section 108, that forgiveness of indebtedness is ordinary income. You cannot exclude that under the Section 121 exclusion that would exclude gain on the sale of principal residence if they met the 2 out of 5 year rule. So for that problem, it becomes that a taxpayer may find that not only do they lose their home, but they have $100,000 of income. And unless they can show insolvency under Section 108, that's going to add to their woes because now no home plus have a large tax bill coming from the backside. This bill was enacted to provide relief to taxpayers in that situation. And what it would provide is essentially for taxpayers involved in this particular, who have this particular transaction, where we have the property taken, for 2007, 2008, 2009, there will be a special rule added to Section 108. And that is that we get relief from this gain on disposal as long as, not gain on disposal, but the debt relief as long as three criteria are met. First, the residence has to be the taxpayer's principal residence as defined under Section 121. That's found in new Section 108B5. The debt has to be no more than $2 million and must be acquisition indebtedness as defined in Section 163H3B. Now, note, that's a potential issue for some taxpayers because what some people did, of course, was they had a home. The values kept rising. They went refinanced and borrowed out the equity, did not use the equity for improvements, significant improvements on the home, but used it to pay off credit card debt. Those individuals are not helped by this provision. That's important to note. If that's what the taxpayer's problem was, this is not going to be there. As well, the exclusion does not apply if the debt forgiven was forgiven for any reason other than the financial condition of the taxpayers. For instance, specifically mentioned in the statute are services performed for the lender. In that case, you do not get the deduction. Now, if you come under this provision, the basis of the residence is reduced. What that effectively does is transfers this amount that would have been a gain on sale, that would have been an ordinary income from the relief of indebtedness, moves it into the Section 121 calculation, where we will then test that against the ability to defer the gain for the taxpayer could have ignored the gain. If the taxpayer could have ignored the gain under Section 121 had it been a sale, then the theory becomes we are able to wipe out that entirely. But that does mean that if we don't qualify under 121 for whatever reason, we may have a problem there. And don't forget, we do have the 2 out of 5 year rule. Now, an interesting open question is whether, shall we say, foreclosure, significant economic harm, is an unforeseen circumstance for 121. My guess is the IRS will be liberal in viewing it as such. But that does mean if you don't meet the 2 out of 5 test, and some of those who got in late may be losing it, you have to worry about that as well. Now, what about the other side, though? What if by doing this you would have qualified for the exclusion, which you could have? Let's presume you were insolvent. Now, the bankruptcy provision of 108 does override this provision. So if the bankruptcy provision applies, you're fine. The bankruptcy rules will take care, and that will get rid of that $100,000 gain. But what if you were insolvent both before and after the $100,000? So even under the old law, you would not have paid tax on the gain. But when I move that $100,000 down and reduce your basis, now I have more than $250,000 of gain or $500,000 of gain, and suddenly have a taxable transaction. The law does provide that a taxpayer may elect to essentially reverse the ordering there where the solvency exemption would apply first, so that we would apply the solvency exemption. So if you would have been able to ignore the gain under the insolvency rules, you can essentially get back to that result, and you don't have to take the home mortgage, which would have the effect of potentially exposing you to a gain on a sale under Section 121. That's the key issue to remember. In any of these transactions where we have debt exchange for recourse debt, the property is worth less than the balance of the debt, and the lender forgives the remaining balance, you have two transactions, one of which is a sale for which we have to go take a look at Section 121, and one of which is forgiveness of a debt where we look under 108. That's important to remember because for taxpayers who also don't meet this because maybe it was an investment property or it had some other factor involved and they're now getting out of this, we still have the bifurcated transactions. For an investment property, we would usually have the calculation under Section 1231 for the amount up to the sales price, either 1231 or gains, losses, etc., for property held for production of income or business property. And then we would have the forgiveness of indebtedness issue under Section 108, and those still take place. If you have non-recourse debt, then the entire transaction is viewed as a sale of the property under Section 121. And again, whether that's good news or bad news is open to question. If you are insolvent, it may be bad news because that sale may generate a gain for which you will not escape taxation. If you are not insolvent, it may be good news because it may be because you get a preferable lower rate for that, or you qualified for the Section 121 exclusion. So it's always a complication when we deal with this matter. Now, this particular forgiveness of debt issue was the centerpiece of this legislation. But that said, there are a couple of other significant issues that are involved in this particular bill you need to be worried about. One that you may not have noticed but now becomes important for sales taking place after December 31st, 2007. A surviving spouse will be allowed to make use of the full $500,000 exclusion in certain cases, rather than being left with their own single $250,000. Under the old rules, we got the $500,000 as long as we could do it with a joint return, but that meant that if one spouse passed away, we had to finish the sale prior to the end of the year in question. So we had to be able to file a joint return to get the full exclusion. Now what they're saying is we're going to give you 2 years to use that up as long as you meet the criteria. What's the criteria? Well, first, the taxpayer must be unmarried. If the taxpayer marries someone else, then they lose that basically carryover $250,000 from their previously deceased, from their spouse that deceased, you know, that was deceased in a year or so before. Now, remember, we still may pick up $250,000 from the new spouse, but obviously the marriage would have an impact on this, and that's something you're going to have to consider if there's a property where this would be significant. The sale has to occur no later than 2 years after the date of death of the spouse. This is not two tax years you get to use, but you have to actually measure from date of death of the spouse. So within 2 years, it has to be sold. And just prior to the death of the deceased spouse, the property must have met the general requirements for the $500,000 exclusion for a joint return found in Section 121B2A. Now, one interesting point to note is you get this full exclusion of $500,000 even though it's going to pass through the estate, or very well may pass through the estate of the deceased spouse, and get to give you at least a partial or potentially complete step up in basis on that residence. So there could be a fairly significant advantage for taxpayers when this takes place. It depends. If you're in a non-community property state, there's always been the issue if it's been jointly owned of that one half you don't get. In a community property state, we usually get the double step up. But the issue there becomes then there can be significant appreciation in the short term, and we still can get the $500,000 exclusion. So that's a fairly significant change in the law. The bill also extended the provision that was added last year as a 1 year only, and now it's going to be continued on through 2010, for allowing some taxpayers to deduct mortgage interest insurance premiums. Now, they have to be paid on mortgages contracts entered into after January 1st, 2007. But we are going to get all the way through 2010 now for this provision. I said a year ago I thought this was going to be an annual extender. It is going to be an extender issue, so we're going to be facing this in the future. It'll be an extender issue that we'll be watching. The Congress changed the penalty for failure to file partnership returns. In fact, they changed it twice, once in this bill and once in the Virginia Tech tax relief bill that we had. And that was a case we're going to take. That's another issue comes up for paying for things. The penalty for failure to file a partnership return of Section 6698 is increased from $50 per partner to $85 per partner per month. And then the Virginia Tech bill raises that to $86 per month, so we get an extra dollar in there to pay for that bill. It also extends the period for which the penalty will apply from the previous 5-month limitation to a full 12-month limitation on this amount. So if you have a partnership return that's been late filed now, we can get a whole 12 months of penalties rather than the cap we used to have at $250. Now, the reasonable basis provision still applies, as does the old ruling that allowed you to get out of that if you could show that everybody had filed and we had all those other special rules that allowed us to get our way out of this penalty. But nevertheless, it is a more significant one for taxpayers who have failed to file their partnership returns. And the new limits will apply to returns required to be filed after December 19th of 2007. Actually, kind of amusingly, it appears the effective date of the extra dollar is one day before the effective date of the 85. So at least on paper, we never had 85, and we had 86 before 85 applied. So it's kind of interesting because the effective date of the bill is in question. So that's an issue for your partnerships. Now, traditionally, we've never had to worry about this issue on S corporations because S corporations always took their failure to file penalty unless we were looking at what was a willful failure to file an information return of Section 7203. For S corporations, the general failure to file rules were the old standard 5% of the tax is due based upon the fact that the S corporation could be a taxable entity. Now, we all know normally our S corporations aren't paying the built-in gains tax or aren't paying the excess passive income tax, and 5% or 25% of zero is zero. So S corporations, unless we had an election that had to be made on a timely filed return, in many cases, there was no real consequence of late filing the S return. Now we find that there is going to be a consequence. What Congress has finally done is gone back and made the S corporation rules like the partnership rules. Except, of course, now this one is $85. It does not appear to get the bump to 86. But we have adopted essentially the partnership rules of the $85 per month per S corporation shareholder up to 12 months will now be the late filing penalty for the S corporations. And again, it is for those returns now due after the effective date of these laws. As such, we need to be aware next year that we can no longer believe that, if the S corporation doesn't get filed on time as we come up to September 15th, and the client doesn't have the information, that we can just let that drift because we know the real due date is the October 15th due date of the individual returns. Now, if you let it slide that month, you're going to pay the penalty for this particular transaction, even if there's nothing that otherwise would require us or make us really be concerned with having a timely filed S corporation return. So we need to factor that in and also make sure your staff and everybody in your firm is aware of that particular new distinction and your clients are aware of that. If you're like me, some of your clients who have, for whatever reason, screwed up, didn't get their S-corporation return filed, you may have at some point told them, well, you know, don't worry, the S-corporation return, yeah, you brought it in, you're a new client, your S-corporation hasn't been filed, but there's no penalty, essentially, for late filing this one, except for our lost elections, if we had any, and you don't have any coming up, so it's no big deal. Now you better tell the clients it's a big deal that they need to get this filed, or else we could be sitting on $85 per month per S corporation shareholder. And if you start doing the math on one that has a lot of shareholders, that could get expensive per month to keep doing. Now, the final bill that passed was the Technical Corrections Act, where Congress went back to fix a few things. And many of these technical corrections, we're going to really concentrate on two of them, but there's a whole bunch of them fixing a bunch of laws that have passed recently. In most cases, these provisions literally are going back to try to fix things that either were drafting errors or that appear to be glitches Congress hadn't thought of when they passed the first bill. The first one that comes up is the AMT refundable credit. And this is one of those things where I think Congress had designed it to function one way, but the fact is that those who drafted it may not have necessarily really thought through the math of what they had drafted and forgot that 20% of a decreasing number, it's not as if you take $1,000 and you allow 20% the first year, there's $800. If the next year you allow 20% of the remaining credit, well, that's not 200, that's 20% of 800, which is 160, decreasing, etc. Those of you who remember the refundable AMT credit when we discussed it and the fact you had long-term credits that were out there over 3 years, and you got 20% the first year, potentially refundable. But the second year, you got 20% of, again, those long-term credits you had remaining. Well, obviously, last year's had dropped them, so you could never get rid of the credits under these provisions on the maximum level unless you got to the point where you could use the $5,000 automatic. What the old law provided was your refundable amount was limited to $5,000 or 20% of the long-term unused minimum tax credit, whichever was greater. Now, the problem, as noted, is that's 20% of a decreasing, that 20% is computed on a decreasing number. It's not as if we had, if we started out with $100,000, we don't get 20 for 5 years. Rather, we get 20 the first year, but then we have to reduce it the second, reduce it the third, reduce it the fourth. So it's not going to get out of the law the way Congress, I believe, thought it was going to when they passed the bill. They misworded it. So now one more test has been added. And that particular test says the final thing, we also can get, if greater, the AMT refundable credit amount for the previous tax year before any reduction by need by terms of adjusted gross income. That means that we could get, if last year was $20,000 becomes one of our limitations for this year. Remember, however, that there are AGI limitations to the use of this provision. And we need to be aware of that. Plus, the long-lived credits do come back to us. So we know we may get others that have to be within a three-year window. So we may be bringing some in. But most taxpayers that were affected by this, to be honest, generated these AMT credits back during the tech boom. And they are going to be able to offset these. The real problem is watching that AGI limitation to ensure the taxpayers are able to make use of these refundable credits. But at least now we don't have the problem that we can't ever really get rid of them. Now, we do have the ability to get them refunded to the taxpayer. Another oops gotcha came in the technical corrections bill related to S corporations. As you may recall, we made a change to the law to make S corporations, in one sense, work more like partnerships, where if the S corporation gave appreciated property, the reduction in the taxpayer's basis was only the reduction of the basis to the basis of the property to the S corporation. The problem used to be that we would basically make our charitable contribution to the charity. The S corporation rules provided, though, that we had to reduce our basis by the deductions. So if we had a piece of property worth $10,000 or that was worth $100,000, basis of 10. When the S corporation made the charitable contribution, we could deduct it so long as we had $100,000 of basis. But the problem was our basis dropped by 100, even though inside the S corporation, we only removed $10,000 of basis and we didn't recognize that gain. What that forced you to do when you work through the math is somewhere you would pay tax on that $90,000 gain, because somewhere that lost basis would come back to bite you. Congress changed the law to say you only reduced your basis by 10, but they didn't change the limitation on the deduction at the time they passed that law. So if I had $20,000 a basis, we made that same contribution, my basis would only be reduced by 10, so my basis in the S Corporation stock would become $10,000. However, I was still limited under the code to $20,000 of deduction because that was all the basis I had in the S Corporation, even though the basis would not be exhausted by that deduction. So then it would come to the ridiculous that then, presuming nothing else happened to the S Corporation, you would keep going then for 9 more years, every year getting $10,000 of carryover because that was the amount of basis you had left. Okay, that's absurd, but that's the way the law worked. Congress has recognized that absurdity, and now we no longer consider that difference between the fair value and the basis in computing the limitations on deduction for the S Corporation. As long as you have basis to absorb the basis that's going to be reduced, the deduction is not limited under this law. Now note, this law has a number of other provisions that are involved with technical corrections. If you deal with the foreign earned income exclusion calculation was changed. There is a new requirement added to a charity certification for donation of personal property that has to indicate not just use by the charity, but substantial use by the charity. And the word substantial is not defined. That may be interesting for us to figure out what that one means. There are some changes made to the penalties for incorrect appraisals that relate to estate and gift returns. The repeal of the limits on estate and gift tax deductions, but not the income tax deductions for certain transfers of fractional interest. The problem there became it would be included in the estate at the full value, but the deduction would be limited by the amount of the initial contribution. For income tax purposes, that worked exactly as Congress intended. Congress didn't think through the negative consequences of that for estate and gift tax purposes, where the estate would be taxed on the full value of what was transferred to the charity, but couldn't get a credit to reduce their gift tax for that same value. So if the property had appreciated, we'd have to include $1 million in the estate, even though we might only be able to get a deduction for $100,000. That seemed unfair since we didn't have the property anymore. Congress has decided, yeah, their problem there was the income tax side of that equation, not the estate and gift. We also had changes to designated Roth contributions in plans, and various other minor issues were impacted. So you might want to take a look at the technical corrections, see where that goes. Note, all of these were passed by Congress before they left town. All of them may impact tax plannings you've done with your taxpayers before this date, so this could be fun. But be aware of these changes, watch out for them, and keep your eye on, you know, all the issues that you may need to be concerned about as we move forward in this area. Now, this has been the Tax Update for December the 29th, 2007. The Tax Update podcast, as mentioned, is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to visit them for information of interest to tax practitioners. This has been the Tax Update, and I wish you all a happy new year.